Hello, Tim. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
No, it's a pleasure, man. This is Kotatsu from Stagefright, and I'm very honored to have you here.
Thanks.
I understand you're a software developer who dabbles a lot in developing for the Bitcoin protocol.
Yes, I am. I've been doing it for about 2 years now. I started making my contributions in open source generally much longer, but Bitcoin specifically, I think most of my contributions have been made within the last 2 years.
Okay, cool. So I'd like to start off with one simple question, right? Do you think Bitcoin is a privacy coin?
I think so, yes. Bitcoin is a privacy coin.
Okay, could you elaborate a bit?
So, I tend to see privacy from its perspective of, when we talk about privacy, I think a lot of people think that privacy is the same thing as anonymity, but not necessarily the same. With anonymity, you're hidden. So even with people who you interact with, they don't know who you are. But with privacy, you have selective, you reveal yourself selectively. So you want a system whereby you can reveal yourself to your counterparty and only your counterparty. So when we talk about the ability for you to make payments or for you to be able to carry out transactions, you really should only concern yourself with the person you are carrying out that transaction with your counterparty, right? And nobody else. Bitcoin actually allows you to do that. But there are lots of ways in which you can use Bitcoin in which it can damage your privacy. And hopefully we'll get to discuss some of those ways and how you can avoid them.
Okay, then let's just do it now. What is the worst way a person could use Bitcoin from a privacy perspective?
From a privacy perspective, I think the worst way you can use Bitcoin is a concept called address reuse. This is where you tend to use the same Bitcoin address with every person that you transact with. So if you have 20 different people that you transact with, whether you are receiving payments from them or you're making payments to them, and all you're doing is using the same Bitcoin address, then it's easy for any of those counterparty of yours to be able to see all your transactions. They can even deduce patterns from all the transactions that you've made. Naturally, the Bitcoin blockchain is transparent, and transparent in the sense that because of the goals of having a global public ledger, it is necessary that all transactions are in the open. So you can see transactions going from one address to the other. And so if you transact with someone and you tend to reuse the same address all the time, your counterparty can take that address, put it on any public block explorer, and then they can see all the transactions that you've carried out. Now, I think you would agree with me that you don't necessarily want someone doing that and seeing all your transactions.
Oh, no.
And so this is the major way through which people actually kind of destroy their privacy when they reuse Bitcoin addresses for every transaction that they do.
Okay, cool. Now, so on the opposite side of the spectrum, how would a person use Bitcoin privately? What is the best thing or the first thing they would need to do?
So, there are lots of things you could do, but if we said that the major way through which people damage their privacy when using Bitcoin is through address reuse, then it's only natural that the way you should use Bitcoin then should be to not reuse addresses. And what do we mean by that? Well, what that just generally means is that whenever you're receiving Bitcoin from someone, even if it's the same person that you've transacted with, you should always use an address that hasn't been used before. Now, the good thing about most Bitcoin wallets is that they can track an unlimited number of, like virtually an unlimited number of addresses. Mm-hmm. And so there is really no, you're not actually saving anyone anything by reusing an address. Bitcoin transactions are not based on an account system. So there's no, oh, this is my, you know, people have this general idea like Bitcoin is like a bank account. And so whenever you give your bank account or your PayPal address to someone, it's always the same ID that you use. Although Bitcoin will not stop you from doing that, it doesn't work on that model. There's no Bitcoin bank account. There's no Bitcoin account. What you have are inputs and outputs. So even if you've transacted with the same address, say, for example, you received 50 different payments on the same address, you don't have one balance. You have 50 different unspent outputs that you could use in constructing a future transaction.
Yeah.
So whether it's the same address or you use 50 unique addresses for all those payments, it's the same thing where the system is concerned. So there's no advantage for you using the same address whenever you only receive payments, even if it's with the same person. You should always use a fresh address that has not been used before. So it's not, oh, I have these 10 addresses, and so I keep rotating them. No, it's not about rotation. It's about generate a new fresh address and then use that for that new transaction.
Mm-hmm. Cool stuff. So then now talking about addresses and or receiving and sending transactions, I think the other thing is that, well, your wallet is one part of the equation, and then we get the nodes that actually broadcast these transactions that go out. And I'd like to know then from a privacy perspective, is running a node a hard requirement or a soft requirement?
So I think when it comes to privacy, there are different ways in which you have to look at it from the perspective of what's the most I can do. So there are different layers to it. The first thing we've mentioned is stop reusing addresses. Now, if you stopped reusing addresses, you would have improved your privacy significantly. Now, if you want to start taking it higher levels beyond that, you get to a point where, okay, if you're looking for ultimate privacy, you have to start considering running your own full node. And you need to understand why is it a requirement that if you want the best form of privacy that Bitcoin has to offer, that you have to run your own node? Well, we have to look at how transactions are effectively propagated on the Bitcoin network. Now, if you're using a light client and you're connecting to a central server in order to submit your Bitcoin transactions to the network, what then happens is that this central node, if they are malicious, they could correlate all your Bitcoin transactions to you. Now, you're obviously connecting from a computer or some computing device. And on the internet, every computing device has a unique IP address. And so it is possible for that central service to look at, even despite the fact that you're not reusing addresses, they could say, oh, I saw a transaction from this IP address with this address. I saw another one with this other address. And over the time of the reuse of your wallet, they could look at all the transactions that you've done emanating from that same IP address, and they can correlate all of them and say, we have a very strong degree of confidence that all these addresses and all these transactions were carried out by the same entity, right? And so that becomes a risk factor in improving your privacy. And so when you run a full node, because every full node on the internet operates on this gossip network. How does that work? When your node first hears about a transaction, if you know, so usually there's this gossip protocol whereby I hear about a transaction, I tell my other peers about that transaction. So mm-hmm. I keep a copy because, oh, this is the first time I've heard about this transaction. I've never heard of it before, but it looks valid. Of course, your full node would have validated those that transaction based on the rules that it has in its own stored within it. Then it will now tell its other connected peers. Mm-hmm. And so because it's constantly doing this, not only for its own transactions, but for transactions belonging to other people, it's very difficult for you to correlate. How do I know that this transaction actually emanated from this node and it's not just one other transaction that is being relayed from that mm-hmm. node? And mm-hmm. so this significantly improves your privacy because if your node is always online, you're relaying transactions coming from one peer to your other peers, and you create your own transaction and you add it to the mix, mm-hmm. there's really no way for you to actually kind of isolate a particular transaction and say, this belongs to this particular node. And okay. this is one of the reasons why running a full node actually gives you a significant amount of privacy beyond just, you know, not reusing addresses. In terms of broadcasting your transactions, you also gain an added advantage in terms of privacy when you run a full node.
Okay. So basically, from what you're saying, just to summarize, the mm-hmm. goal with using Bitcoin is to reduce the number of third parties involved in your transactions.
Yes. So it's reducing the amount of third parties, unauthorized third parties that mm-hmm. Are able to link a transaction to your person.
No,
like I said, all transactions are public. Mm-hmm. But when transactions actually start, and you know, here's the thing about Bitcoin transactions. For a very long time, the Bitcoin community thought that pseudonymity was the same thing as anonymity, right? And the reason mm-hmm. is because Bitcoin addresses, by their very nature, are not tied to a person's identity. Mm-hmm. You generate a random number, and from that random number, you generate a Bitcoin address. There is no, you don't register that random number with your identity and say, this particular Bitcoin address belongs to Tim, or this particular Bitcoin address belongs to Mary. No, you don't, mm-hmm. the Bitcoin protocol doesn't work that way. However, you have a lot of blockchain surveillance companies that are trying to break that pseudonymity. And so they're trying to correlate these Bitcoin transactions with certain heuristics, like I mentioned with running a full node. If you have these transactions coming from the same IP address, they could infer that that particular IP address is the owner of that particular transaction. And so what you're trying to do in terms of improving your privacy is that you want to be able to create a Bitcoin transaction, and you want to be able to do it in such a manner that it's very difficult for a third party who is not authorized to be able to create a link between your own real world identity and a particular transaction that happened on the Bitcoin blockchain.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Nice stuff. So basically, it's the whole major argument, trusted third parties are security holes.
Correct.
Okay, cool. So one other aspect I actually wanted to talk about, right, is then, well as you're saying, the public Bitcoin public key address is just there, and people can only link you to it if you broadcast the fact that this address is mine. Uh-huh. How is it that Satoshi Nakamoto basically used Bitcoin for a number of years and people still can't, or people didn't trace it back to his actual identity?
So, remember we started out by the fact that Bitcoin can be used privately. Mm-hmm. It turns out that the major way people dox themselves when it comes mm-hmm. to Bitcoin transactions is, like you just mentioned, trusted mm-hmm. third parties. The moment you open an account with a Bitcoin exchange mm-hmm. and you identify yourself through, mm-hmm. you know, all the necessary KYC and all that, that is not to say that that is bad in itself. However, you have some of these exchanges that work with some of these blockchain surveillance companies that mm-hmm. then use all that KYC information to tie your transactions on the blockchain with your identity. And how is that done? Well, whenever you're going to transact with the exchange, you're going to deposit funds on the exchange. Now, the exchange was the one that generated an address for you to send the funds to. And so it is assumed that any funds you sent to that address, the funds must have come from a wallet that you control. Mm-hmm. Also, when you make a withdrawal from the exchange, it's assumed that you're withdrawing the funds to a wallet address that belongs to you. So mm-hmm. what is blockchain surveillance companies now do is that they use a bunch of heuristics to kind of observe the flows of funds from these addresses that they have, you know, certainty that are linked to identity. And mm-hmm. then they try to create these graphs of transactions and addresses to try and like cluster addresses into identities, right? Mm-hmm. So as at the time when Satoshi actually was using Bitcoin, there weren't exchanges, right? Nobody knows Satoshi's real identity to this very day. So mm-hmm. he could have, you know, if he actually signed up with an exchange, it will have been so obvious who Satoshi is. And mm-hmm. I mean, you have people who knows they know what particular coins belong to Satoshi, right? Why? Because they, just by looking at the transactions on the blockchain and looking at all the blocks that were mined prior to when Bitcoin was beginning to be adopted, it's obvious that we know, you know, with a certain high degree of confidence that these addresses mm-hmm. must have belonged to Satoshi. Now, mm-hmm. fortunately for us, those coins have yet to move, right? So mm-hmm. we have roughly about 1 million Bitcoins sitting in addresses thought to belong to Satoshi that have not moved ever since those funds got in there. And mm-hmm. because those coins have not moved, it's almost nearly impossible for you to, as a matter of fact, even infer relationships. So you can mm-hmm. tell, for example, that, Satoshi transacted with, I mean, we all know that Satoshi transacted with Hal Finney, but we don't know any other person whom, maybe there are other people whom he transacted with. But those people don't know his identity. But imagine, for example, that we were carrying out a transaction together mm-hmm. and you are signed up with an exchange and I send coins to you and then you send those coins to an exchange. Well, the exchange can actually look two steps back and can tell mm-hmm. that the coins that you sent to the exchange were actually gotten from an address. Well, we might not be able to tell who was that person, but we know that if we come to you and we ask you, we notice that on so-so-so day at so-so-so time, you transacted with some individual. Mm-hmm. We need to know who that person is. Well, if you were actually subjected at gunpoint to reveal my identity, you might actually do that. And that might actually also end up doxing me as well. Okay. So that would never happen with Satoshi because nobody ever knew who he really was, right? So even mm-hmm. if you put a gun to one of the people who transacted with him back in 2009, you still wouldn't be able to know who he was or mm-hmm. who they were or who she was.
Okay, cool. The whole put a gun to a person's head is actually something else then, which forms like a bigger part to the whole Bitcoin privacy argument, like the whole mm-hmm. $5 range problem.
Yeah.
Like no matter how well you secure your wallet and stuff, if someone knows that you have a huge chunk of Bitcoin at some point you become a very attractive target, which is, I think, why most Bitcoin exchanges get hacked, or initially why they would get hacked, because they had so much Bitcoin on the platform that any hacker who could hack them found it hard not to hack them, because they just had so much Bitcoin on them. And then now this translates back to the individual. Mm-hmm. There are people who are whales in the space. And now they have this huge chunk of Bitcoin, and they're doing their best to not make their identity known, that, oh, this specific cluster of Bitcoin belongs to me. Because once that happens, then they better have bodyguards protecting them from the whole $5 range problem, where they move these coins into this address, or you are getting shot right now, or they're getting tortured to actually move that. And I find it interesting, because I was thinking about it earlier this week, and I'm like, wealthy people are not new to the world. You know, people have been rich for decades. For centuries, actually, even starting from when gold became a thing, and kings and queens and stuff like that. But Bitcoin has the unique property where a person can put the majority of their wealth behind a mnemonic seed. And due to its liquidity and how easy it is to move these coins, I don't think there has ever been monetary asset that has been this easy to move and this liquid at the same time, where, you know, it getting moved is just one transaction that gets settled in approximately 10 minutes. And that really makes keeping Bitcoin privacy way harder than it actually is to this day.
So there are, you know, people say that there are two roles to Bitcoin. The first role is that you always talk about Bitcoin. And the second rule is you never talk about your Bitcoin, right? And I think it's for the reasons that you've stated, where you have this monetary asset that is incredibly liquid and has the ability to teleport from one region of the globe to another in seconds. It creates and it's also a bearer instrument. So if it's stolen from you, that's the end. There is no authority that you can go to for redress. The coins are stolen and they're stolen, right? We've had lots of cases involving things like ransomware, where people actually, you know, their data or, you know, some private information of theirs is held to ransom until they pay the ransom, right? And it's turned out to be very, very effective for these criminals who engage in this activity, for it to be very, very lucrative for them, because you're dealing with an asset that guarantees an extreme level of ownership with whoever is the bearer of the asset. And so when it comes to individuals who are looking to store their wealth in such an instrument, it actually requires a lot more responsibility from them in order to protect this asset. And so, you know, this whole mantra behind you never talk about your Bitcoin, it goes a long way, because it doesn't even matter how much you have, right? Any amount of Bitcoin is too much, because you're dealing with an asset that could be worth a lot in future. So it doesn't matter if today you're bragging of your $1,000 investment in Bitcoin. Who knows what it's going to be worth in 10 years? That particular statement that you put out on social media now becomes something that you regret, because now the whole world knows that you have this amount of Bitcoin. And so you effectively put a target on your back whenever you, you go about doing this. So when we talk about you protecting your privacy, besides the fact that you're trying to protect your privacy on chain, you also have to protect your privacy. And some of these social attacks could also be vectors through which you one person could actually get attacked. And so I think it's also important that people exercise some level of situational awareness when it comes to how they talk on social media, on public forums in general. You want to be sure, because if you're in a situation where you are attacked physically because of the knowledge that they know that you have a specific amount of Bitcoin, it's going to be difficult for you to get away with it. So there's something in you know, called plausible deniability, where if you don't know how many Bitcoins I have, there's no way for you to prove that I haven't. If I happen to be attacked, there's no way you can prove that the amount of Bitcoin that I I'm now claiming to have is not all that I have. It also works the other way too, because I can't prove that the amount of Bitcoin that I can't prove the amount of Bitcoin I don't have, right? I can't prove that I don't have Bitcoin, but I can prove that I have, right? So if someone puts a gun to my head, or someone, you know, at gunpoint, you're told that you have to reveal your keys, and you reveal, you know, maybe you have this wallet that actually has a small portion of your Bitcoin holdings, and that after a lot of pressure, you give in and you reveal that, there's no way for the attacker to know that you don't have more than that. Unless, you know, there has been other information that has been leaked online, or that you have personally revealed about yourself, that gives them that, no, I expect that this person should have between this amount and this amount of Bitcoin, right? And so basically, that is what they're going to be working with.
Basically, donation addresses.
Yeah, that is correct. But you see, the thing is, over the course of the years, it is possible, except there are addresses that can be tied directly to your identity. Maybe, like you mentioned, donation addresses. If I put those donation, if I put that donation address online and I see that you have 10 Bitcoin in it, then I have all certainty that you have that amount, right? And you know, you can't deny that you don't have access to that. But again, you have people receiving Bitcoin, spending Bitcoin, and so, you know, unless you actually have addresses that you can directly correlate to a person's identity, you can't really tell for sure how much Bitcoin a person has without, you know, doing a lot of extra work in trying to figure out which addresses actually belongs to this person's wallet.
Okay. No, man. Interesting stuff. I think Bitcoin privacy is a really tough topic, because ultimately privacy, personal privacy, is also a tough, tough topic. So one can only go so far with improving their own personal privacy. But I think one thing I like about Bitcoin, it actually leads a person to increasing their total level of personal privacy. And all the advocates for better Bitcoin privacy practices end up with better personal privacy practices, because you can't have one without the other. And so, yeah, everyone should just practice some Bitcoin privacy so that they can have better personal privacy. So yeah, I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, so, you know, we've mentioned at least two different ways in which you can improve your privacy when it comes to how you use Bitcoin. There are also numerous other techniques. And usually when you're trying to improve your Bitcoin privacy, you have to be aware of the actors who are working against your attaining this privacy. And I mentioned the fact that you have blockchain surveillance companies that are consistently trying to break users' anonymity, right? And so there are several other techniques. For example, these are more of the advanced techniques that you can employ in trying to improve your privacy. So for us to actually understand how these techniques actually work, we need to understand how Bitcoin transactions themselves are created. Every Bitcoin transaction is made up of inputs and outputs. The inputs are kind of like the coins that you have in your wallet. So think about when you want to make a cash transaction. Let's say it is a, so we're talking about the South African rand, for example. And let's say you want to make a 25 rand transaction. Now, depending on the denomination of notes you have and coins you have in your wallet, you are going to create a transaction by adding up all these notes and coins to make up at least that amount. When you're doing cash transactions, a lot of times you have to make change because the amount you have is slightly bigger than what you want to pay for. So when you make that payment, you receive change back for that payment. Bitcoin transactions are exactly the same way. Whenever you have coins or outputs, unspent outputs in your wallet, and you want to make a payment, your wallet will add up all these coins as inputs in that transaction. They will make an output for the payment and also make an output for the change. So that change comes back to your wallet, and then you can spend it in a future transaction. Now, when you look at how those transactions are created, it looks as though for every transaction, all the inputs are created by the same entity. You know, so as we know, for example, if I am spending cash, if we were to look at that transaction and it was public information, it's obvious that all the cash came from one person, right? And depending on the amount, if we see, oh, we know that usually rounded amounts are like, so let's say it's a 24 rand and, you know, what's the smaller denomination, the, like if we had something like 24.99, what would the 0.99 be called?
I don't really know.
Right. Okay. So that small portion, let's say
4 cents. That,
yeah, let's call it cents, right? So we have 24 rand and 99 cents. The 1 cent change that gets added back, we know that, oh, that's obviously a change. We know that that's change. So we would guess that that 24.99 rand output is the actual payment. Now, you have a lot of these blockchain surveillance companies that are looking at these heuristics and are coming up with guesses on how these addresses are actually controlled. And so when they look at a particular regular transaction on the Bitcoin blockchain, it looks as though all the inputs belong to the same person. So I can then trace back from the output and say, okay, this output I'm sure was paid into by Tim, right? So if I look at that transaction, I look at all the inputs, maybe there are 15 inputs. I know that all those, I can guess that all those 15 inputs came from a wallet controlled by Tim. Now I can even start looking backwards and saying, okay, where did these 15 inputs come from? Oh, they came from these 15 individual transactions. And I can start tracing back and trying to form an idea of all the addresses in Tim's wallet. So I use these techniques to kind of like form a cluster of addresses that to a high degree of probability belongs to Tim. And so when you have this kind of heuristics, and to a large extent, they're true, but it's not necessarily always true. And this is where we now start looking at all the techniques on how you can improve your privacy. when it comes to how you use Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. One of those techniques is called coin join.
Okay.
And with a coin join transaction, you are trying to thwart these heuristics by creating a transaction in which you're not only the participant, but you have other participants joining their own inputs into your transaction to make it look as though all those inputs came from you. Now, mm-hmm. it's like if you have a bowl of beads, right? And all these beads are effectively the same. If I take a new bead and I put that bead in the bowl and I mix the bowl, and I tell mm-hmm. you, pick the particular bead that I put into this bowl. Now, because all the beads look exactly alike, it's an impossible task for you to do. You can't yes. pick with certainty and say, this is the particular bead that you put in. And with Bitcoin, I could have put 5 beads. I could have put 10 into a bowl of 100. You don't know the number of beads I put in, and you don't know the particular beads that I put in. So it's at that particular point, you can automate a system to de-anonymize or try and filter out which particular inputs that I actually made. So mm-hmm. with Bitcoin, you can actually create a transaction, put in inputs that belong to other people, sign yours, and have others sign. And as far as the blockchain is concerned, it is still one transaction. But now you can't tell how many participants were actually involved in that transaction. And so you break that heuristic, and we call it in Bitcoin privacy parlance, we call it the common input ownership heuristic. So it's this whole heuristic whereby we assume that all the inputs are owned by the same person. But with coin joins, you break that particular heuristic because you can't make that assumption anymore that all the inputs are owned by the same individual. And so when you actually create coin join transactions, you're able to mix your inputs with others and you break that heuristic. So it makes it impossible for this blockchain surveillance companies to be able to go further than that. With a lot of the coin join implementations, they not only just make it possible for you to create transactions that are coin join transactions, but you could actually start out, say, for example, I bought Bitcoin from a KYC exchange that works with a blockchain surveillance company. When I withdraw that coin, I know that the company knows the address I withdrew the coin to. But what I mm-hmm. do subsequently is I now subject that particular coin to a series of coin join transactions to obfuscate where eventually the coins end up. So maybe it's, okay, I'm going to have this coin go through a series of 5 coin join transactions or 10 coin join transactions. And through all those different hops, you're constantly just breaking that link between, yes, we know that you withdrew to this address, but they can't tell where the coins eventually ended up. Mm-hmm. We talk about the fact that Bitcoin transactions are censorship resistant. And this is the truth from a protocol perspective. But what we've noticed with a lot of wallet services and exchanges is that they try to make it difficult for you to use Bitcoin in a censorship resistant way. And what do I mean mm-hmm. by that? Whatever excuse is it that they give for doing those practices, they tend to try and figure out several hops down the line where those coins end up. If someone decides that, I want to buy Bitcoin and I want to use Bitcoin to gamble on some sites, and for some reason that goes against the policy of the exchange that I'm buying my coins on, because they can actually trace where you're, spending your coins to, it makes it impossible for you to use Bitcoin in a censorship-resistant way. You're being censored. Someone is telling you that you can't make this particular kind of transaction. And mm-hmm. this goes against the whole idea of Bitcoin in the sense that you should be allowed to make whatever transaction that you deem as being appropriate. It's the same thing with speech. If we say that we support the idea of freedom of speech, where people are allowed to speak their mind about societal issues and not be afraid of having repercussions as a result of that speech, the same thing should also apply with transactions as well. As it's a form of expression, it's a form of speech. And so if we agree that we should protect people's rights to speech, then we should also do the same too when it comes to the ability to do transactions. And so coin joins are one of those techniques through which you can actually obfuscate how coins actually end up being spent. It's a privacy technique, and if we had more people actually doing coin joins, Bitcoin will become so private that blockchain surveillance companies will totally give up in trying to trace any transactions, because what's the point? It's completely useless. And then there's another technique, and this one is actually even more interesting in the sense that the thing about coin join transactions is that you can easily detect them on the blockchain. You can look at a transaction and, you know, a common blockchain explorer, for example, blockstream.info, it does have this privacy heuristics that it can tell you what kind of privacy techniques were used in a particular transaction. And it's actually able to also tell if a particular transaction is a coin join transaction or looks like a coin join transaction. And so you can easily tell that a particular transaction is a coin join transaction. However, there is a new technique, not really new, but it's gaining popularity, and a number of wallets or merchant payment systems are beginning to implement it. It's called PayJoin. So when you do a transaction in a coin join manner, you are effectively mixing your coins with N number of third parties. And this could range anywhere from 3, 4, 5 to even higher numbers, 50, 100, right? But when you're doing a pay join, you're effectively making a payment to just one person, but that person is also joining their own independent inputs with your transaction. So I want to make a payment to you, and so I create a transaction that pays you, right? So you have your funds, and whether or not we engage in a pay join would not deny you of that payment. Okay. So you receive the payment, and then what you do is you now add one of your inputs to the transaction. Now, the inputs will effectively be paid back to you, okay? But the whole idea is that, remember we talked about this common input ownership heuristic, is that now you can't really tell. If you try to do this whole wallet clustering thing, because of that pay join, we have effectively merged our clusters. So you have this system that will fool blockchain surveillance systems into thinking that my own wallet is the same as your wallet because we engage in a transaction where both of our inputs were involved. Now imagine you as a merchant, you're doing pay join with me, you're doing pay join with your other customers. Maybe you have 100 other customers. Do you know what eventually happens is that all our wallet clusters now become merged into one. So we now have a wallet cluster of 100 different wallets that, according to this blockchain surveillance companies, is the same wallet. Now that completely breaks that heuristic again, because now they can't reliably say with any degree of certainty that this so-called normal looking transaction is actually made up by one or two participants. And it turns out that this can be a very, very effective technique in creating transactions that look like every other day transaction, but it has this added benefit of confusing blockchain surveillance companies and their algorithms into not being able to, you know, tell a pay-join transaction from a regular transaction on chain. And so if you have more people actually doing pay-join transactions, and I actually see that within the next couple of months, we're going to start seeing a lot more wallets. I know, for example, that Blue Wallet recently also added that feature. So it would actually propose a coin, a pay-join transaction if the recipient actually supports it. So I think we're going to be seeing more of, and there's a lot of research going into Bitcoin privacy, and we'll be seeing a lot more of this privacy techniques being implemented to restore Bitcoin fungibility and make Bitcoin private for people to use. Remember, privacy is not about it's not about hiding illegal deeds. It's about selectively revealing information to third parties. So I should be given the right to choose who I want to select, who I want to reveal the purpose of this transaction to. I shouldn't have some third party elsewhere breaking my anonymity and you know, being able to tell what it is that I'm spending money on, or where I'm getting my money from, or how I spend my money without my permission.
Cool. All right, Mike, thank you very much for this conversation. I think from a time perspective, we've ran quite long, but I think there's quite a lot of stuff we have to discuss that we probably can't fit into one episode. So I think I'm going to have to call you again one day and then continue this magnificent conversation.
I look forward to having another session with you.
Cool, man. Thank you very much for sharing the knowledge.
It's been my pleasure.
Cool. Till we talk again.
All right. Later.